Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. Dr. Rick Hansen is a psychologist, senior fellow of Cal Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, and New York Times bestselling author. He's lectured at places like NASA, Google, Oxford, and Harvard, and taught meditation centers around the world. He's an expert on positive neuroplasticity, and his work has been featured on everywhere from the BBC, CBS, NPR, you name it, he's been there. He began meditating in 1974, the year I was born, and his incredible book titled Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness is a title and a subject which we can all relate to today in 2020. It's an honor to have Rick on the podcast today. Rick, welcome. As a huge fan of your work, it's an honor to have you here. So it's about time. And it is the time to have you here, given what's going on in the world.
It is a time to develop resilience and use it every day. And I want to take this chance as well to say, I'm so impressed with MindBodyGreen, have been through and through, just the quality level, the writing level. I've written a couple pieces for you, and I know from the inside out how carefully your editors take the material that you publish to the world, including making sure that it's solid and referenced and all that. So actually, it's a two-way honor. I'm happy to be here too.
Well, thank you. You were so kind. And for our editors listening, you guys are fantastic. And real feedback from someone whose feedback we really value. So thank you. So you mentioned resilience, and yeah. You know, we have to start there. Two of your books, it's uncanny how relevant they are. And we must start with Resilient, and literally the subtitle is, you know, the title is Resilient, How to Grow an Unshakable Core of Calm, Strength, and Happiness. And I can't think of a more timely title given the state of the world. So the big question, the loaded question, how can we cultivate resilience?
Well, the short answer is, the good news is that we totally can. The how of it is to develop psychological resources inside, inner strengths, we could call them, like grit or gratitude or compassion. And so if you just think about those as like muscles right there, grit, gratitude, compassion, we develop them in a two-step process that's based on how the brain changes for the better, that we can take charge of, which is incredibly hopeful. You start in the first step by experiencing whatever you want to grow, a moment of determination, a moment of feeling strong, a moment, let's say, for grit, of feeling like you will endure. So you start with the experience. And then, based on how the brain changes, you have to help that experience leave a physical change behind. Simple to do, though. Stay with it for a breath or longer. There's a famous saying, neurons that fire together, wire together. So the longer you keep them firing, the more they'll be wiring. Feel it in your body also. If you have that gritty sense of strength, feel it in your body. It'll leave a bigger trace behind. Also, focus on what feels good about it. We internalize what feels good to us. And so in this simple way, a breath here, a minute or two there, you truly can grow inner strengths inside yourself, which is extremely hopeful in part because you have the power to do it yourself, especially useful at a time when we're pushed around by so many big forces around us.
So can we unpack grit,
yeah,
and then gratitude, and then compassion, those big three, if you will. Let's spend some time. Mm-hmm. Let's start with, you know, grit. How do you think about grit, why it's so critical, yeah, what we need to do, and so on?
Yeah, well, to frame it, grit is what's left inside us after everything else is worn away, if you think about it. And there's a lot of research going to Angela Duckworth at Penn and other people who've shown that one of the differences between people who recover quickly from challenges, we're all banged by life, right? The question really is, how hard does it knock us? And then how rapidly can we return to a healthy baseline? So a lot of the research shows that a major factor is what could be called a sense of determination, fortitude, patience, and a sense of feeling just, you are a strong person who will get through this. You might be scared, you might be sad, you might be outraged on behalf of others. It's all there. And meanwhile, you are going to get through this. I say this from studies on people who've gotten through the worst of it. including the Holocaust, going back to Viktor Frankl. And I say this as someone myself who, while I've not had any kind of traumatic life history, I've also done a lot of things in wilderness that were extremely dangerous and challenging, a lot of rock climbing, things like that. And you, even if the storm has come, you know, even if you're tired, even if you're cranky, even if you're mad at your partner for dropping his jacket that you got to go find, true story, still, you're going to get through that. So that's grit. And the key takeaway, again, is we can grow grit. We can become grittier, and which is fantastic. So grit.
And so how do you exercise that grit muscle, if you will?
Okay, that's great. So we have these two things here then. We have, right, we have the using it and we have the growing of it. And the good news is that while we use it, if we get in touch with our bodies and open to the experience as we use, let's say, grit, we will strengthen it through hardwiring it increasingly in our brain, which then, in a positive cycle, means it's easier to tap into. So right at this time, for example, to be really concrete, I would suggest people could do different simple things. Like, for example, when faced with a challenge or there's something you're worried about, right? Start, or as soon as you can, tune in to the felt sense in your own body that you are a strong person. You can get through stuff. You've endured hard times in the past. Tune into the feeling, especially of this. You might know it intellectually that you've got through stuff, but it's deeper and more powerful to really feel it in yourself. You could do that. You could feel the strength in your legs. You could feel the enduring nature of awareness itself. Awareness is a refuge. It's enduring. No matter what passes through it, awareness itself is stable as awareness. You could rest in that. You could tune into a really important aspect of grit is to claim what you see. Claim what you know. In other words, see what you see and know that you see it and know it for yourself. Many of us grew up in situations, I did too, where it wasn't safe to admit to our parents or the world a lot what we actually knew was true or what we saw or what we felt. We were outnumbered, outgunned, and so forth. But as adults, it's really important to say, no, I know what I think is true. Right. For example, about public health experts, you know, I know what I think is true. I think masks are important. So I'm going to wear a mask. I know what I think is true. We could take refuge in that sense of conviction. That's an aspect of grit, for example. So these are different ways to tap into and use the grit we have. Another one is really important. It's so great. And it's so consistent with mind, body, grit, right, is to tune into the feeling of ongoing being. Still here. That's kind of the essence of grit. You know, I'm not going to swear on
this here.
Podcast.
Still here.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, I'm still here. Screw you. Like, heck with you all. I'm still here. Right. And that ongoingness of all rightness, the heart is still beating. You know, I'm still enduring. I'm still here. I have not been destroyed by this. That also is a very important aspect of grit and one that's continually available to us to recognize that in this moment, I'm basically all right right now in the present. That's another aspect of grit, coming into the present. So much of our stressing and worry has to do with what's called mental time travel, where we, you know, obsess about the past or worry about the future. And that it's useful. A little bit of that goes a long way, right? The actual development of the neural circuitry in the brain and the midline of the cortex that enables us to do that is a great development, fine. But there's a lot of suffering and a lot of taking life personally based on going inside and ruminating and having these little mini movies running that involve mental time travel. So a way to break through that is to come into the present. And in the present, you feel gritty. You feel stronger in the present. So those are some ways.
And what about gratitude?
Gratitude is beautiful. You know, it's fundamentally, it's about thankfulness. It's about receiving the gift. It's interesting. We might be glad that we get a paycheck, but we don't particularly feel grateful for it. We feel like we earned it. There was an exchange of value somewhere in there. We feel grateful for gifts, which brings us into a beautiful and for some people challenging sense of humility and dependence. Dependence on the air we breathe, which is given to us by green growing things, the oxygen in it. Dependence on all those people who've helped us along the way. You, for example, did not have to do this podcast with me. I feel thankful. I feel that you are making a contribution. It's not more than what it is, but it's sure not less than what it is. It's real. And, you know, I appreciate that. So there's a lot of research that shows that one of the factors that help people get through really, really terrible things, like a combat tour, say, tour of duty somewhere, frontline responders, is a sense of gratitude for what is still good alongside what's bad. It's very important. This is not a spiritual bypass. This is not positive thinking, rose-colored glasses. Gratitude actually helps us deal with losses. I think about, for myself, a difficult time in my life during my father's last months, and there were a lot of complicated issues around it. There was a lot of craziness around it, a lot of upset around it, and it was a one-way trip. Things were, you know, getting worse for him kind of inevitably toward the end. And I would walk out of the hospital and I would just sort of shake my head at all that had happened. And then I would look out and I'd see people leaving the hospital in their wheelchairs with balloons on them, going home to their families. I would see the orderliness of the setting there, the moon, the big full moon rising over the medical center. And I just felt a lot of gratitude for all that was also true. That's gratitude. And we can cultivate trait gratitude. I mean, the broader point that I was making about the two-step process of learning is really the movement from states to traits, right? We have states, we have experiences of, say, gratitude, and then we internalize them in that second necessary step of getting those neurons to wire together. So we can acquire trait gratitude, which then fosters state gratitude, which we can reinforce in a wonderful upward spiral. So you can develop trait gratitude over time. And I think that there are many objects of gratitude. There are many sources of it. Grateful for other people, grateful for the gifts of life altogether, grateful for having put things behind you. You don't have to deal with junior high school anymore, right? And ultimately, for many people, there's a spiritual dimension to this as well, in whatever way. Just for me, the amazingness of the universe altogether blows my mind every time I think about it. And more broadly, you know, I'm really grateful for living today rather than 150 years ago. I'd rather be, you know, a pretty ordinary person today than the richest person in the world 100 years ago, for example. And so, gratitude.
Perspective comes a lot into that one, huh?
Yeah.
And
there's a vulnerability.
Yeah.
You know, I could see your face soften and my face soften because we're seeing each other. I could feel my face soften. Just talking about gratitude, it softens us. We're receptive, you know? And I think, if I could just say this culturally, with this intense emphasis on individualism, you know, in the Western world, certainly in America too, it can move us away from a recognition of all that we receive. And then it can get politicized and people start flaring around the notion that, well, wait a minute here, I did build a lot of my business, right? Sure, I have built a business myself. It's not at the scale of Mind, Body, Green, but, you know, in my way. And yet, I couldn't possibly have done the business I have without the internet. And I didn't make the internet. Thank you, internet makers. You know what I mean? So there are many things that we can appreciate receiving while also, you know, respecting ourselves and knowing what we've earned through our own efforts.
I love that. I love that. And I think it's so important to remind ourselves of that, you know, that there are so many greater forces than ourselves individually or collectively as a community. There are, you know, when we start to, you know, it ties so nicely into gratitude, you know, the air we breathe, that footstep we take, the smell of the roses, whatever it may be, we had nothing to do with that.
That's really good. You know, I'll do a practice from time to time when I sit down to a meal in which I'll look at something on my plate, like a tomato, and I'll just slow it down kind of quietly, and I'll reflect on all the causes and conditions, or some of the many causes and conditions that put that tomato on my plate. You know, the people who grow it in the various farms, the people, many of them relatively poor and if not oppressed, undocumented workers often, who picked that tomato, the people who drove it, the technological systems that brought that tomato to my home, the the people that work in the grocery stores and whatnot. And then I think about the domestication of tomatoes, because of course that's the kind of strange stuff I think about. Nobody had a tomato 10,000 years ago. They were domesticated slowly but surely through amazing processes of all these people. Think of all the people over the centuries and generations of tomato cultivation that are present in that. And then you think about the larger processes of that tomato is congealed sunlight, basically. A giant ball of burning gas, more or less, just has sent energy to our planet, which has been internalized in green growing processes that is now manifest in that bright red tomato on my plate. Just that, 30 seconds of that, just, and you kind of feel it, you know what I mean? You know it, but the key is to feel it. So you know it, feel it, kind of the felt recognition of what's true. Just that, just takes you out into everything. Opens you out into everything, brings you into this deep feeling of appreciation and gratitude, which is pleasurable in its own right. And also it strengthens you for dealing with hard things, making you more resilient too.
I think our audience now has a whole new appreciation for tomatoes. I certainly do. And then, so the last point, compassion.
Yeah. Well, if I could just geek out one more second on tomatoes.
Of course.
One of the most amazing facts I came across just in the last half dozen years is that, and you may have known it a long time before that, is that every element in the universe, bigger than helium, was made inside a star, usually as the star was blowing up to drift through space. So the water in a tomato, oxygen and hydrogen, H2O, right, in a tomato, plus all the other little other things in it, like carbon or calcium or who knows what's in a tomato. That stuff's made inside a star. We're sitting there having stardust for dinner. Wow.
I love
like
it.
How do you not know that and then feel it? And how do you be cranky when you know that that's true, right? At least at the moment that you know it.
I love it. I love it. So compassion.
Yeah. Well, compassion, simply put, is the wish that beings not suffer. It's grounded in empathy for them and benevolence. So I'm saying stuff you know, but I'm just kind of walking us through it. Compassion without empathy is just performative. I've been on the receiving end of people phoning in compassion who couldn't be bothered to feel in any way, shape, or form what it was like to be me, for example. So we need to have both empathy and benevolence for compassion to be there. Compassion is bittersweet. There's the bitter of the suffering that we empathize with broadly, the stress, the weariness, the burdens, just the life, sometimes the losses, sometimes terrible injustice that has landed on someone. And there is the sweet then of the kindness for them, the supportiveness, the warmth, the wish that they not suffer. We can certainly apply as well compassion to ourselves. Both forms of compassion are well-identified factors of resilience because they do different things for us. They open our heart, which helps stabilize us in a felt sense of our own body. They draw us into relatedness with others. That's really good. And kind of weirdly and amazingly, they help us deal with those who have wronged us in a way that makes us somehow feel better. Weirdly, if we can find compassion for the person who wronged us, doesn't mean we agree with them. Compassion is independent of judgment. It's independent of discernment. It's independent of justice seeking. We can have compassion for people that we believe belong, in the, justice system, should be prosecuted and should go to jail or something like that. So we can have compassion in that way. What's interesting at a personal level, I know for myself, I never get free in a interaction that's stressing me. Because a major challenge for resilience is hassles with others, right? I had a little back and forth with my wife this morning about a bottle of vitamins. She's a holistic health practitioner in California. She has an acupuncturist license, which is a powerful license here. She does a lot of essentially functional medicine kind of things. So we had a funny little back and forth where she got a little, pissy with me about a bottle of vitamins I was asking her about because she's our vitamin provider. And I don't really get free of any kind of upset like that, which was minuscule, let alone larger upsets, until a couple of things happen, until I sort out and include my own responsibility. What was my part? Not to overclaim responsibility, but to recognize it. Oh, okay, I could have said it differently. I understand there's like an ambiguous message I gave her. There's a history between us about, you know, the hassle it is to get my vitamins for me, blah, blah, blah. So I took responsibility and also to have some compassion. You know, she's dealing with stuff. Who knows? She just woke up. She's a little groggy. I don't know. Compassion doesn't mean giving her a pass, let's say, but having compassion for others is weirdly freeing for us. And then we're not holding the inner grind of our upset with our person inside our head when we find compassion for them. So that's another major factor of resilience. And actually, ultimately, widening the circle of us. You know, we're profoundly tribalistic animals. We evolved in mainly hunter-gatherer settings until extremely recently. Our 300,000-year-old immediate anatomically human ancestors, and then another couple million years before that of tool-making hominids. We're tribal. So we live with 40, 50 people our whole lives. It's our nature, often competing with other tribes for scarce resources. So it's natural to contract the circle of us to something pretty small, and then that gets easily manipulated by authoritarian demagogues, blah, blah, blah. We've seen a lot of that.
By Twitter,
over history.
By social media.
Yeah. And currently. So I'm blathering. Bottom line point, compassion helps us expand that circle of us. Even if we disagree with others, we start to recognize that we're just one huge whole human tribe, all 7.5 billion of us, and we're in this together. And if there's anything that teaches that we're in it together, it's a plague sweeping through, because it's precisely our social nature that makes us vulnerable to a plague.
So you mentioned suffering. Do we need suffering? What do you mean? Do we need? Is it part of the process? Are we not fully developed if we don't have enough of it? Like, what's your general take on suffering? How much is inevitable? How much is too much? And where does it come into play with our development? As you know, fully actualized individuals and the society, if you will.
Yeah, I feel that's one of the deep questions. I'd be interested in your take as well. I mean, first, there is suffering. There is physical and emotional discomfort, pain, distress on a range from subtle to agonizing. It is the case. The Buddha made a really useful distinction, you may know it, between the first and second dart, the first and second arrow, sometimes called. First dart being inescapable pain. You drop a brick on your foot, it's going to hurt. Someone you love dies, you're going to feel upset about it, or you see someone brutally murdered in plain view with a knee on his neck. You're going to feel the first dart. It's okay to feel the first dart. And it's interesting as a detail here. I'm just to think about the languaging. One way to understand what the Buddha was talking about is that these are ennobling truths. It actually ennobles us to face suffering and to recognize the causes of suffering. So that's inevitable. Then there's the second, third, fourth, fifth darts we throw ourselves, where we add anger to our hurt, where we get caught up in fantasies of vengeance and ill will toward others, when we beat ourselves up. That's unnecessary. So thus the saying, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional, way to understand that. And then there's a question, which is a very deep one, about what's the value of suffering? Okay, now let's get into it. So suffering does open the heart. Sorrow tenderizes the heart, you know, as the saying has it, on the one hand. On the other hand, I think it's really easy to overvalue suffering. And there's kind of a pocket industry of people who I think overvalue it, because the truth is most pain has no gain. Most of our suffering does not teach us anything, does not make us stronger. Actually, prolonged suffering tends to make people weaker. You know, if anyone knows the dangerous effects of stress long term, it's mind, body, brain, right? There's so much evidence for the wear and tear of emotional upset as a major stressor. Being irritated is stress. Being anxious or lonely is stressful. carrying resentments or beating yourself up, feeling like a bad person is stressful, and that's going to wear people down. Also, even if you grew through your pain, right? I do think there are certain lessons that you only get when you go through pain. There are certain things I now know going through the death of both my parents that I wouldn't have grown in any other way. There are certain forms of growth I've had dealing with wilderness challenges that I wouldn't otherwise have acquired. Okay, that's true. But on the whole, when we say we've learned from our painful experiences, could we have learned it in other ways? Could we have grown in other ways? And then most fundamentally, the primary process of growth is really interesting to study. How do we actually grow? We grow by experiencing what we want to develop and internalizing it. That's it. And the experiencing of what we want to develop is usually enjoyable. It's enjoyable to experience gratitude. It's mostly sweet to feel compassion. There's a little bit of important learning that's not pleasant, like deepening a moral sense, facing, for example, as I'm really looking hard at these days, whiteness and white privilege and just what that's all about. There's discomfort in that. Our son, Forrest, recently did a podcast episode that we do in which he said we should be uncomfortable speaking as a white person to other white people in America, and certainly I think as well around the world. So all that said, there's a place for that, you know. But mostly, the enjoyability of certain experiences is an indicator of their value. Why push them away? Why not internalize them, right? When you have a chance to have a feeling of grit or gratitude or compassion or a sense of accomplishment or feeling valued and cared about by other people, why not take it in? Why not feel that longing place inside your heart? Why not take it in to heal those wounded places inside you? And why not take it in to grow muscles, psychological muscles, in effect inside, to become stronger?
And so you mentioned anger. And yeah. A lot of people are angry. A lot of people are frustrated, and mm-hmm. rightfully so. So how do we stay present through that? How do we channel that anger and frustration as, you know, a force for good, for personal development? Mm-hmm. How do we not let it consume us and take us to a place that's not productive, if you will?
Yeah, it's a huge, deep question. A couple things about it just stand out for me. One is that anger is unique among all the emotions in two important ways. Number one, it feels pleasurable. Anxiety doesn't feel good. Sadness right. doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
Shame, inadequacy doesn't feel good. So you think of the four major sort of so-called negative emotions kind of on a spectrum, but anger has this hot rush. It's organizing, it energizes us, and neurologically, it's associated with increases of dopamine and norepinephrine, neurochemical systems in the brain, and dopamine in particular has that sense of reward. So anger is particularly seductive. Precisely because it feels rewarding, we need to be careful about it. Second, it's unique in that it gets foregrounded instantly. It becomes the most salient emotion interpersonally. So, you know, when someone's sad, when someone's worried, when someone is feeling lonely or blue, we're pretty okay with it. But as soon as somebody gets angry, like my wife was a little irritated with me this morning, woof. We all listen to it, right? So it has a lot of impact. In that context, then, anger has tons of value. It focuses us on what's problematic. It mobilizes us to deal with it. As a longtime psychologist and psychotherapist, I'd much rather have an angry client than a depressed one. Part of the movement sometimes in helping people who are depressed or anxious is to encourage anger, you know, as an intermediate stage. And there's a very important place morally for anger on behalf of others. I went to Haiti some years ago because we supported some projects there. I'd never been to a third world country before in a serious way, and Haiti is almost like a fourth world country. When I reflected back on the time I spent there, I realized I had been in a cold rage the entire time. I was calm. I'm a pretty mellow guy. I was calm. I was appropriate, and I was in a freaking cold rage. I was appalled. I was stunned. I was in a cold rage, and I was glad I was. And I think rage was a kind of appropriate response to what I was seeing there, right? On the other hand, anger is not something we want to marinate in all the time. It wears us down. There's some languaging, and there's a metaphor from the Buddha. He talks about anger with its honeyed tip and poisoned barb. And also the metaphor of, dumping anger on others is like throwing hot coals with both hands. Well, pardon me, hot coals with your bare hands. Both people get burned. So when I think back on my mistakes in relationships, what I consider to be my mistakes, they almost all began with anger, my anger. So I think it's important to be careful with anger, to feel it, to let it flow, to make the distinction the Dalai Lama did between anger and hate. I think hate is poisonous, it's corrosive, contempt. As soon as we start sliding into ill will, fantasies of vengeance, contempt, we're in trouble. On the other hand, truly healthy anger, I think, can serve us in a lot of ways and is appropriate about a lot of things.
So what's also top of mind for me, and I think a lot of people, and you mentioned this earlier, is we all know being in a constant state of stress is not good. And there's a lot of stress out there right now. And you wrote in your recent book, Neurodharma, you talked about this concept of how we can handle stress on a daily basis. And so can you unpack that a little bit for us? How can we handle stress in an age of, whether it's COVID-19 and deep social unrest, to say the least?
Right. Well, I like to try to frame this a little bit, which is it can be easy sometimes to think that what I'm talking about, or anyone who kind of is in the territory, let's say, of positive psychology, that it's somehow it's some sort of putting lipstick on a pig or, overlooking things. Totally not that. It's about growing strengths inside to deal with what's awful, whether it's out in the streets or in the world or in your own mind, right? To deal with the hard things. First point. Second, it's clearly possible to have a sense deep down inside, even with regard to anger, let's say, in which you're feeling things on the periphery of your awareness, right? You're irritated about this, you're angry about that. But most of your experience in the moment is centered in a feeling of clarity, purpose, efficacy. In other words, that you're making things happen. You're a hammer, not a nail. You're mainly a hammer, not a nail. That's the core of your experience. That's why I use the term the unshakable core, that sense of something deep down inside that has a gritty quality to it, because that's what remains when everything else has been worn away, that there's a deeper level inside you, or you could say a kind of ground or space in which experiences occur. That's really important. And being able to identify increasingly with that underlying sense of all rightness and worth and love and heart and courage, whose root, as you know, is heart in the meaning of the word, underlying emotional balance and underlying serenity, frankly. I think of it a little bit like it's as if we're a pond. In the mountains, imagine a mountain pond, and imagine a storm coming through, really disturbing the surface of the water. And yet, if you could just kind of hang out and it weren't too cold, 5-10 feet below the surface, it would be really quiet there and still. And we can be that way inside our own mind, in part to become more effective in what we deal with, as well as to feel more well-being. So it's in that context then that it's important to realize that just because there are challenges doesn't mean that we have to be stressed. Just because there are stressors doesn't necessarily mean that we have to be stressed inside. And you could really think that a lot of, for example, Mind Body Green, the material there is about developing inner shock absorbers at all kinds of levels, whether it's physiological or psychological, internal shock absorbers. It's very important. So that's how we can deal with stress more effectively. And then for me, as a really practical person, I'm a methods guy. You know, I consume a ton of research. I produce just a little, but mostly I'm just practical. Like, how can we live better and all the rest? And to me, it takes us back to what are those key strengths inside that would help a person these days? Grit, gratitude, compassion, those are key. Feeling loved, feeling cared about in authentic ways, really a key. Feeling like a fundamentally good person, you know, still working on stuff, but deep down inside, you know, you're a good person and you can take refuge in that knowing. You know, this is how we deal with stresses. And I guess to finish, I have kind of a little boom, 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 boom kind of way of doing it. Deal with the bad, turn to the good, take in the good. To me, that just summarizes so much. Deal. We got to deal. We got to cope. Yeah. But don't get stuck there, because then if we just get glued to what outrages us or obsessed with the problem, we have no breathing room. There's no shock absorber. We have to turn to the good that is also true, in part because it helps us deal with the bad, and then take in the good so you become stronger every day.
So you mentioned the good and the bad and positive psychology. And why is it that, you know, we are hardwired to be pessimistic? And, you know, what can we do about that?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny. Like, I look around the room I'm in right now, or I see the room you're in, and, you know, there are electrical lights, there are walls, we're using technology. And it's really startling to realize how profoundly unnatural and odd this way of life is, because it's utterly different from the Stone Age template, if you will. And then more deeply, the Jurassic Park template. of who we are, the blueprint going all the way back 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system. Biology matters. And cutting to the chase, down that long run, we have developed a brain that's like Velcro for bad experiences, but Teflon for good ones, right? We have the brain's negativity bias, it's called. And the why of it is really useful to understand, because it, in a way, it lets us, it makes it easier to deal with. It's not our fault, but it is our responsibility to deal with. So our ancestors needed to get carrots and avoid sticks. Well, if you don't get a carrot today, food, let's say, you'll have a chance at one tomorrow. But if you fail to avoid that stick, that predator, that aggression in your primate band or between you and another Stone Age band, or in Game of Thrones, right? If you don't figure out quickly how to deal with Cersei, you're not going to live to see the sunrise. Yeah, you're going to be in deep trouble, right? In the wild, eat lunch today. Don't be lunch today. And so netting it all out, you know, sticks have more urgency and impact than carrots do. So it's natural. So the brain actually does these five things routinely. Scans for bad news, overfocuses on it, overreacts to it, fast tracks it into emotional memory, and sensitizes the brain to the negative through cortisol, which sensitizes the amygdala and weakens the hippocampus, a part of the brain that calms down the amygdala. So it's natural to have the negativity bias. It's useful back in Jurassic Park, right? It's useful today in certain situations, but for most people, most of the time, it's kind of a well-intended delusion, in a sense, that we've evolved, that makes us overreact to negative and under-recognize and definitely under-learn from, under-grow from the positive. And the takeaway for me is, respect the power of that side of the force, right? And appreciate that if you just sort of marinate in negative emotion, it's going to get really fast-tracked into your brain. It's going to shape your brain pretty quickly. Not good. Deal with the bad. Recognize it. Feel it. Open to it. Don't suppress it. You know, welcome it. Grow resources inside so you can bear your pain. You know, deal with it. And also, as fast as you can, drop the chalupa. You know, disengage, right? Shift gears. As the saying has it, most episodes of stress in the wild end quickly, one way or another. Right. Whereas I had a surgeon client who told me that in the OR they had a saying, all bleeding stops eventually, one way or another. But anyway, disengage, move out of it. Don't just marinate in stress. Disengage and then turn toward what's wholesome and helpful. And in fact, sometimes what is specifically an antidote to whatever you're struggling with.
Yes, yeah, something I've said recently, you know, with regards to what's going on in the world is, look, you need to be aware, you need to be informed so you can, mm-hmm. you know, develop your own opinions. But at the same time, you need to be aware of when it's taking over your yeah. your life or going to a place yeah. that's not productive and tune out. It's yeah. it's a balance because you can't just say, hey, I'm not going to pay attention to this at all. It's you yeah. know, it's too upsetting because that's not, inaction is also not a productive place to be. So it's a delicate balance of you need to tune in, you need to be aware, you need to be informed, but at the same time, you can't let it overtake you.
Yeah, it's really kind of wild to think about it. So imagine people, let's say a person asks themselves, well, if my life is like a mosaic, say with 100 tiles, factually, what's the status of those 100 tiles of my life? You know, the food I eat, the bed I sleep in, the pillow my head rests upon, the music I get to listen to, the things I do each day, you know, the interactions I have with others. Bottom line, if you were to sort of go, okay, green, gray, and red, in the way you would look at the objective nature of your tiles, I think for imagine the number of people for whom it's mostly green with some gray and a little bit of red. That's the reality of their life, a fair assessment. Well, why don't you feel that way then? In other words, if we go from what's the objective nature of your life as you see it, fine, what then is your experience as you move through your day? Are your experiences mostly green with some gray and occasionally red? And if not, why not? They ought to be. And then to take it a step further, what about the people whose objective conditions are mostly red with some right. gray and a little bit of green? In those cases, more than ever, it's important to pay attention to the green tiles, the green aspects of your life, including your own qualities inside, your own nature, your own mind, your own good heart, because it's by drawing strength from those green tiles that you become more able to deal with the red.
So how can we empower ourselves internally to be the good activists and the good allies that so many of us want to be right now?
On this one, I want to really underline my lack of expertise. I'm grappling with this at a personal level. I have reasonable expertise in certain topics. This is something I just want to really be clear about. You know, I'm just kind of speaking from my heart as one more person. So for me, a key is to keep challenging myself to open wider, to recognize what's true and how it is for other people, and to be brave enough and strong enough to be uncomfortable, to be really uncomfortable sometimes. And if I wish there was a word that was even more intense than uncomfortable, anguished, appalled, deeply disturbed, just can't not think about how horrible it is, you know, from time to time. There's a place for that. So that's one thing I do. And then second thing is I try to focus on what I can actually do. I wrote a piece recently, you mentioned it before we started recording here, called Vote, in the context of this weekly newsletter I have it's about practice. How can we have a simple practice each week, just one thing each week? And if you think about it, vote, the root of that word is vow. What's your vow? What are you committed to? So it's claiming the power you have and then using it to a good purpose, as you judge best. So I'm not saying how a person should vote, including in narrow ways at the ballot box, but that we should vote, period. And we vote in lots of ways. We vote with our attention. We vote with our speech. We vote in how we speak to other people about an important issue like white racism. We vote in, you know, sending money here or signing a petition there. We vote, you know, claim that and use it. To me, that's worth doing morally, and it is helpful to ourselves to know that we're doing what we can. Right? Do what you can. I mean, we had a presidential election 4 years ago in which half the country shrugged and said whatever and did not vote. And the younger they were, the less likely they were to vote. And so to me, that is kind of a larger context. And then I think the last thing is take care of yourself along the way. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I grew up at a time where there were massive changes, civil rights movement, environmentalism, women's rights, gay rights, tremendous things. I was at UCLA in 1970, spring of 70, as a freshman when all the campuses erupted after Kent State and Nixon invading Cambodia. And I watched hundreds of police officers come onto the UCLA campus for no reason at all after a rally had occurred 3 hours before, and moving through the campus, students began to gather, and I saw the cops just beating the crap out of a lot of people. So I've seen a lot of things, you know what I mean? And one thing I've seen, and I've had friends who are incredibly key activists. I mean, I've known famous people who are activists, and I'll protect their privacy here from. And one thing that's crystal clear is that if you don't take care of yourself along the way, you can't keep up the good fight. If you burn, like you said, if you're thinking about it all the time, you're going to burn out. You've got to walk away. You've got to make yourself a cup of tea. You've got to go get a donut. Oh, excuse me, a really healthy donut of some kind, right? But you just got to take care of yourself too along the way.
So to close, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm a hope guy. But I don't have the perspective, the life experience that you have. And you know, what is your hope for this moment? So that's, you know, in my opinion, we don't want it to be a moment. We want it to be a movement. We want it to be a shift. You know, how are you thinking about what's happening in the world right now? And what is your hope of, you know, where it's going to take us in the future, a year from now, a couple of years from now, and so on? What is your hope for us as a community, as a society, as a global culture, if you will?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to frame it a certain way. So I think about process, you know, so I'm a process guy, right? What's the process? You have good process, you'll have good product, right? So if you have problems with outcomes, you have to look at process. And what's happened in, you know, America, obviously in the last 30, 40 years, has been a disruption of good process. And what I mean by that is the foundational basis for any kind of healthy relationship of telling the truth and playing fair. That's foundational. On that foundation, you compete, you struggle, you know, people have different views, they have different values, but fundamentally you tell the truth and you play fair. And in terms of playing fair, your word means something, and if it's bad for the other guys to do it, well, it's bad for you to do it as well. So for me, we need a restoration of truth-telling and fair play, justice, in all kinds of ways. How are we going to accomplish that? Here's where I will express a political opinion, distinct from a civic opinion. My civic opinion is that everybody should vote. My political opinion is that the best thing we can do for the planet by far is to elect Democrats across the board, whether it's the city council, the library board, state legislature, president, Senate, and then after that, figure it out. And so I'm hopeful that that's actually going to happen. And I'm hopeful that broadly in terms of racial injustice, let's say, that as the polls show, there has been a tipping point in this country. We've seen a different tipping point some years ago, just a few years ago around gay marriage. We saw a similar tipping point shift around decriminalization of marijuana, for example. And I think I grew up with major tipping points. As I wrote in my little essay on vote, when I was in 1963, I went to North Carolina with my family for the summer. I was 11 years old, and I needed to use the bathroom in a gas station. And I walked toward the bathrooms, and I saw three doors, one marked men, women, and colored. Times have changed, actually. There's been a shift. And then on the other hand, I think we've seen over the last years, essentially the sort of pushback from the authoritarian male who's resisted these cultural changes, including the ascent of women. It's kind of the appropriate rise of women. And one thing that can really be helpful, I recently, with my wife, watched the first seasons of West Wing, the West Wing, the TV show. It's kind of startling. If you look at a show written by a bunch of Hollywood liberals, you know, this barely, I don't even think even 20 years old, you'll see the treatment of women in it in a way that's shocking, that you would not see it accepted at all in any kind of television program today. There's been a lot of change, and then there's a lot of pushback against that change. And I think we're seeing kind of the last spasms of, you know, kind of white nationalism, white male nationalism especially, kind of slowly trying to push back, trying to rig the game, because that's the only way they can win. But they know the demographics are against them. They know the tide of history is against them. Young people are much more open-minded and progressive. So long term, I'm really hopeful about that. I'm hopeful about the rise of the middle class worldwide. I'm hopeful about the democratization of information worldwide. I'm really hopeful about that. I'm scared about the power of totalitarian regimes, like frankly the Chinese government, to use forms of social control and monitoring and surveillance in ways that are, you know, would make George Orwell blush way beyond what he imagined in 1984. I'm really concerned about that, and I think we have to really come together in a new kind of way to stand up against that as a collective. But fundamentally, I'm really hopeful. I think there's going to be terrible crap along the way. Global climate change, terrible, terrible, terrible. The most vulnerable people will probably see a billion deaths over the next several decades, if certainly through this century, the consequences of global climate change, probably. You know, terrible, terrible things. But on the whole, you know, I think, what is the, you know, the deep proverb, you know, the arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. I'm hopeful there.
Well, I am equally hopeful. And as we say at Mind Buddy Green, we're all in this together. You, we all. Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.